Now, our reading today again is from the book of Ruth, chapter 2. The little book of Ruth, chapter 2. It's a lengthy chapter, but I think we have to read the whole chapter for what I have in mind. Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, go, my daughter. And she went and came and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and her hut was to light on a part of the field belonging unto Boaz, who was of the kindred of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said unto the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered him, the Lord bless thee. Then said Boaz unto the servant that was set over the reapers, whose damsel is this? And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, it is the Moabite's damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. She said, I pray you, let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came, and hath continued even from the morning until now, that she tarried a little in the house. Then said Boaz unto Ruth, hearest thou not, my daughter, go not to glean in another field, neither go from hence, but abide here fast by thy maidens. Let thine eyes be on the field that they do reap, and go thou after them. Have I not charged the young men that they shall not touch thee, and when thou art athirst, go unto the vessels, and drink of that which the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face, and bowed herself to the ground, and said unto him, why have I found grace in thine eyes, that thou couldest take knowledge of me, seeing I am a stranger? And Boaz answered and said unto her, it hath fully been shewed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thy husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother, and the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people which thou doest not heretofore. The Lord recompense thy work, and the full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou hast come to trust. Then she said, let me find favour in thy sight, my Lord, for that thou hast comforted me, and for that thou hast spoken friendly unto thy handmaid, though I be not like unto one of thy handmaids. But Boaz said unto her, at meantime, come thou hither, and eat of the bread, and dip thy morsel in the vinegar. And she sat beside the reapers, and he reached her parched corn, and she the reaping was sufficed and left. When she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not, but let fall also some of the handfuls of purpose for her, and leave them, that she may glean them and rebuke her not. So she gleaned in the field of the leaf, and it beat out that she had gleaned, and it was about an acre of barley. She took it up and went into her city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after that she was sufficed. But her mother-in-law said unto her, where hast thou gleaned today? And where lovest thou? Blessed be he that is take knowledge of thee. And she showed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, the man's name with whom I wrought today is Boaz. And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of the Lord who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead. And Naomi said unto her, the man is near of kin unto us, one of our next kinsmen. And Ruth the Moabite said, he said unto me also, thou shalt keep fast by my young men until they have ended all my harvest. And Naomi said unto Ruth her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maiden, that they meet thee not in any other thing. So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of barley harvest and of wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. And that's a very healthy reading. It will certainly have far more details than we cover tonight, but we will make a selection from it. I see that we have some folks with us, and we're glad to see them tonight who were not here, were not able to be here last night, and we really cannot take the time to cover all the introductory things that we said, but there are some matters that we did mention last evening, and I think to be fair to all who are here, I'd have to mention them again so that we can go on. We have all been impressed, I know, many, many times with the special charm of the little group of Ruth. I mentioned last night that nearly every type of person is able to find something, whether young or old, male or female, rich or poor. There is something in this book that applies to every different group at every different station and gender in life. It is a book that has, even in the realms of literature, it has been considered a special gem and has all the qualities of a very interesting and engaging story. Not everyone, of course, has appreciated the book. It was one of those beautiful parts of the Bible that was particularly attacked by Thomas Paine. You will have heard of him, I'll read you just some of what he said. He was a great antagonist of Christianity back in the 18th century. And in his famous work, or infamous work, The Age of Reason, he said the Book of Ruth is an idle, bungling story, foolishly told. Nobody knows by whom about a strolling country here. Heavy stuff indeed to be called the Word of God. What a poor pain. It is a pain to read a thing like that. A man who has to read it from St. Ruth and put that into another print, he must be one of the greatest pains of the human race. It was about the same generation as that man that Goethe, the German playwright and novelist, he said about the Book of Ruth that there is nothing so lovely in the whole range of epic and idyllic literature as this book. I think that as far as literature is concerned, he certainly had much better taste than the previous man. It is a book that is very, very refreshing in its reading. After you have, I use the word waited, after you've waded through the turbid water of the 21 chapters of Judges, and one wave of wickedness after another just rolls across, it's refreshingly edifying to come into the four chapters of this beautiful book. To read a book of wickedness and war, and to come to a book of wealth and worth. To read a book of idolatry and immorality, and come to this lovely little book of integrity and dignity. To read a book of vice and fire, and to come to this precious book of value and virtue. There's something very refreshing just to come into the changed atmosphere of the Book of Ruth. Another thing that makes the book very precious to us all is that there's a simplicity with it. We're taken back into the simple beauty of family life. And you read about births and bereavements and burials. And you read about some of the simple institutions of ancient agricultural life. And work in the field. And you listen to the women talking in the village. There's something about the Book of Ruth that gives us a glimpse again into the simplicity of pure family and social life. You know, I feel that maybe in our busy world of technology that we are beginning to lose, even as believers, beginning to lose something of what God really intended in the beauty of family life and in the simplicity of the ordinary things associated with earth and agriculture and those matters. We have it all here, and it's not just the simplicity of those things. We have that. But the marvel is that in the ordinary events of family things, marriages, friendships, and the birth of children, and the passing of this generation, the arrival of a new generation, in the ordinary events of life, we can see that amongst such people, the God of heaven was advancing his work, and he was moving forward his purpose in a very, very remarkable and providential way. You know, many of us will never be great, and many of us will never be famous. The most of us around here, we would just fall into the category of rather plain and ordinary people. I hope I won't insult you when I say that. Just ordinary people. And we may be inclined to think, well, you know, I am just a very ordinary family, and I have very, very ordinary connections, and I just work at a very down-to-earth job, and I just have a very, very plain, non-illustrious pedigree, and there's nothing much that I will ever do. My dear Christian, can I encourage you with this? That the most of the people in the Bible that carried forward God's work were just ordinary people that were used by Him. And let us not forget that the ones whom God in providential wisdom used to introduce His Son to earth was just a poor peasant Jewish girl. So none of us should ever be discouraged. The Bible stories that are collected around Bethlehem are very, very beautiful stories. And I just mentioned the arrival of the Lord Jesus. Now, as those who were here last night will perhaps remember, I said that out of all the many things that are interwoven in the texture of these chapters, we were going to try and take out just one thing for the sake of these four meetings. Now, the strands in the book, they just don't go straight from one end to the other, but they're twisted and turned and woven in through each other, so that if we take our strand, we will from time to time have to take a little look at one of the other strands. But to a great extent, we will try and keep to the one particular thing. Now, I identified that thing last night, and this, for those of you who have already heard this, I beg your indulgence, this is a little piece of very necessary repetition. We notice that in the book, in the first three chapters, there is a recurrence of a rather unusual word. It's the word kindness. Or, translated as the adverb, kindness. Ruth said to the two girls, she said, "The Lord be kindness with you, as you have dealt with your husband." We have read a verse here tonight, and I'll come back to it in a minute, where Naomi said, "Blessed be he of the Lord who has not left off his kindness to the living and the dead." And we will put a good bit of weight tomorrow night in the will of the Lord on what Boaz said to Ruth in chapter 2. He said to Ruth, he said, "I want to tell you," he said, "your present kindness is even greater than your previous kindness." So this word kindness is certainly a thread that comes up with the terminology of the book of Ruth. Now I spent a while last night, and I'll not just spend as long tonight, I think, but I spent a while trying to explain it. You see, sometimes it's translated as mercy, God's mercy. Sometimes it's translated as goodness. Sometimes translated as kindness, sometimes as loving kindness. Loving kindness is a term that was brought into our English Bible by Magnus Coverdale in his translation many years ago, and then the King James then carried it through. Now, Hebrew scholars have investigated this word very, very thoroughly. And they have come to the conclusion that the word does refer to kindness. But there's much more in it than just kindness. And going through many of the different references, they have noticed that this word kindness is very, very, very frequently associated with the idea of covenant. So it's not just kindness in the sense of a person being generous and a person just being kind. They are kind because of a relationship that exists. Because of some kind of an agreement that has been made. And I was going to different verses last night. For example, at the end of Micah, it says that when God is going to bless Israel in the future, that He performed His truth to Jacob and the mercy. That's the word. The mercy to Abraham. Now, why will God show mercy to Israel in the future? Well, you say he's so good because he's a generous God. Not exactly. God will show mercy to Israel in the future because many, many years ago, God made a commitment to Abraham. And because of that commitment made to Abraham centuries ago, God will honor his commitment and he will be gracious and he will be generous to the descendants of Abraham in the day to come. So that we came to the conclusion. In fact, I just read what one of the men said after pages and pages, I have a number of monographs at home dealing with this Hebrew word, the word chesed. He said, chesed or kindness in our English, it presupposes a common and has from first to last a strong suggestion of fixedness, steadfastness, and determined loyalty. Now, I repeat what I said last night. In this word kindness, there's love, but there's also loyalty. In this word kindness, there's compassion, but there's also a great degree of commitment. In this word kindness, there's feeling, but there's also faithfulness. Right down towards the Old Testament, again and again you read about mercy, or kindness, and truth. They are twin sisters. And after all that talk, we give the conclusion that one of the main things, and I say again, not the main thing, but one of the main things of the book of Ruth, was this great subject of commitment, or loyalty. See, Ruth, as I mentioned more tonight, Ruth was loyal to her mother-in-law. Boaz was loyal to his commitment as a relative and as a redeemer. The Lord was loyal, as we see in some of these passages, he was loyal to the commitments which he had undertaken for the nation, so that right through this book that was written and located in the days of the churches, that's what makes it so refreshing. In these days, when everybody did what was written in his own eyes, and there was a tremendous sense of lack to that, here we have a little group of people, Boaz, Ruth, Naomi, and a few others, and in the midst of laxity, they were marked by loyalty. And in the midst of carelessness, they were marked by commitment. And in the midst of compromise, they were marked by conviction. Now, it wasn't either. They were constrictive. They said last night that, dear brothers and sisters, it's really a concern upon my own heart, and I think others, many others feel the same, that in our day there's a tremendous lack of commitment. And I'm thinking especially about the assembly thing. Now let me be very, very straight to you. I hear many talk, and they say about people that will see them on Sunday morning. You never see them to the next Sunday morning. That's talking about people secularizing in that. Talking about people that creep there at the house. You don't see them, and you're doing well if you do see them. Never see them every 2 Sundays. Never see them at a prayer meeting. Never see them at a Bible reading. They just come in. They just are like a body on a chair. They slip out. They carry no load. They perform very little service. They share practically no responsibility, and they're in the assembly, none of them. But I'm afraid that they seem to know very little about commitment. Now I think that we can take a look at the characters in this book, and we can learn some kind of lesson from them about this subject. Now, there's our chapter today, together this chapter, and I'll be Maybe that's some of the great things. You see, talk to him at this stage with a picture of the assembly. Some of the things that I say will relate to the assembly, right? But I'm not taking the chapter to be a picture of the assembly. I'm not taking the night bowls to be a picture of the Lord Jesus. That's something that's done by our brethren constantly. And I would love to do that. It's a very nice devotional study. We're not going to look at the chapter typologically or prophetically or dispensationally. Nothing like that. We have a far more modern approach in these few minutes. We're just going to look at the chapter exactly as it is. Just plain history. Human beings who live and show great loyalty in the midst of a difficult time. Now, first of all, let us think about God. I see this man as certainly a real embodiment of commitment. You see, we're first introduced to him right here in the first verse of chapter 2. It says, I only had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. You say, in what sense was this man committed? Well, the first sense that I would say is this. He was committed to the Lord. Why did he not read? Why did he stay through the fall? Why did he not follow the example of his brother Elimelech? The famine's over, the difficult days are past, the Lord has visited his people, there's the appearance of fresh harvest, and here the man is still there. He has stood his ground. He has maintained his position. He has stayed by his post through the difficult years when other people were migrating and they were going for an easier option. Here the man seemed to stay, and now when it's over, the man who has stood his ground, it seems to me that he stands with dignity. And he has gear. And he has an authority. And he has a respect. And he has a nobility. Isn't that enough to let us see that possible to stay, even when things are difficult? Now, the one thing that's said about this man here is that he was a mighty man of wealth. Not mainly that he had a permanent money. That's how it appears just as we read. It may not. Actually, that expression, a mighty man of wealth, is most usually considered in the Old Testament, a mighty man of valor. It's an expression that's generally used for a warrior. Not so much a man of name, but a man of courage. Again, it may refer to a man who has resources. Not resources in finance, but resources in character. That's a really wealthy man. And I'm inclined to think that perhaps, well, I don't know, I think he was a fairly wealthy man, the rest of the book bears that out. But I'm inclined to think that there's a fair wee bit of the last idea in this expression, a mighty man of wealth, so that when other people were moving, here's a man of courage. Here's a man of conviction. And here's a man of character. And he was able to say it to that. You see, you know as well as I do that a crisis manifests the measure of a man. We can all be great Christians when things are going easy, and when things are favorable, and when things are coming hardly, and things are just nice, we can all be great Christians. But you see, it was the famine. It was the famine that took a little life away. But the very crisis which made one man leave was the same crisis which allowed another man to stay, and the man who stayed has proved God, and he has become a mighty man of wealth. You see, dear brothers and sisters, we do not write this, I know. But really, it's crises that sports character. It's emergency that moves character. And here we have a crazy and resources that he trusted in God, of course, that's in it. But I think one of the very basic reasons is that Elimelech appreciated that this is God's inheritance. And God has given me this inheritance. I have no directive to go. And if God has given me this inheritance, how dare I ever think of abandoning it? And he didn't only live it, but you know, he kept laboring in it. The things come, and you're crying, and you're sowing, and you're getting on. It's a waste of time. Sure, God has let us down a bucket of them. You say that this is the land of the God of Israel, and there's not a blade of grass or a head of barley to be seen. It's just a waste of time. No, no, the man realized, this is God's inheritance. The hand of God might be upon us in discipline, but God's hand of discipline is no excuse for our disobedience. And he lived in it, and he labored. Thank God the day came when the sowing and the laboring proved to be fruitful and the Lord visited his people and better times appeared. It may be that I'm speaking today to some assembly here, some brother, that you're about to give up because some conditions have come and things are not easy. And there's a lot of plowing and sowing and laboring and very little to show. And you say, the sooner I get out, the better. I'll tell you, dear brother, you put your trust in God and be a man of character. And the day may yet come when barrenness will turn to mountain and when famine will turn to fruitfulness. Don't give up too easily. Here's a man, he had commitment to the law. Another thing that I would say about him that comes out very, very much in this chapter, he had commitment to the law. Now, away back in some of those passages that you're familiar with, in the book of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, there was just a small law. It wasn't one of the big major parts of the law, just a small clause or two, in which God said, he said, when you're reaping your field, he said, don't clean up everything. He said, leave a little bit for the poor or for the widow or the stranger. I said, you haven't had a good harvest for years. We haven't had a good harvest for years, and we're lying behind here, and we're going to have to get out and forget about those small bits and pieces just now. We need to get every piece of grain that we can get, and we are going to clean everything absolutely clean. Don't know where to cover it with the stranger. Now, we need to get the barn still, for they've been empty for a long time. No, no. Even despite that, it seems to me that this man was very, very particular. That if God has given a law that accommodates the stranger, he said, I'll accommodate that law. Is it a very nice thing just to see a man who has an interest in an outsider? No, I want to say another very practical thing. We're not doing anything typical or anything like that. I'll say this, dear brethren and sisters. We should have a very sensitive spirit to the treatment of outsiders. Now, sometimes I'm dismayed how little place we have for them. You see, he noticed it. Right away, as soon as he walked into the field, now there were other young men there, there were girls there, but right away, I'm not sure why he picked her out, he knew right away, there's somebody that's ever been here before, he noticed her. And then he very sensitively, he made inquiries about her. He said, who is it? And privately from the overseer of the field, he gleaned as much information about this girl as he could glean. And having noticed her, and having inquired about her, then he spoke to her. You know what she said to him later on? She And I'll tell you one of the things that I've appreciated, sir, since I came into your field is you spoke that. In a friendly word. Actually, one of those expressions, speaking friendly and speaking comfortably, one of them is an expression that's quite frequent in the Old Testament. It just means to speak to the heart. Now you just imagine for a minute. You imagine the tension that Ruth must have been under. She didn't know the supervisor. She didn't know the owner of the field. She didn't know one of the workers in the field. She knew that, generally speaking, gleaners weren't welcome. Because gleaners were considered to be a bit of a nuisance. They were going about after the reapers, and they were intending to get in the way, and the gleaners just didn't like it. So they're going out to glean. It was a kind of a task, and you'd be uptight about it. And you'll just be wondering, will there ever be a field where I will be welcome? And will there ever be a field where I not be cold shoulder, and I not be abused, and I not be harassed? I tell you, when she got into this field, she appreciated the man. She said, I never expected. It was good to get a place to glean. But she said, I haven't only got a place to glean, but she said, the man that owns this field has been very, very kindly disposed. See, here's a man, and he's not just fulfilling the law. That's the point. He's actually going an additional part. Then, of course, you get better still. When it came to his time, he had to be brought to share the meat. Where he himself, as the owner of the field, the great landlord, and he brought her in to share a place at the table, and as that matter still, he actually put his hand into a very, very special delicacy, and he gave her more than she was able to eat. And he made her feel nearly like one of themselves. She was a foreigner, but he made her feel just as welcome as though she were an Israelite. You see, that's commitment. This man wasn't committed just to do the law. He wasn't committed just to the letter of duty. But I tell you, he not only fulfilled his duty, but he went even the second night, as I was mentioned yesterday. Then he did more. When the lunch was over, he told the wife, I said, don't you make this girl feel uncomfortable. And he said, I'll tell you more. He said, don't not only allow her the permission to read, to glean, but he said, when you are cutting, it's probably the girls and the young men and the young women that work for those, the most likely thing is that the young men did the cutting, and the young women did the tying. Now he said, when you're doing the cutting, he said, you actually pull a bit out. You know what I mean? I believe that there was hardly ever a greener of such statement before. Here a man is committed with a generosity. He not only regards the old law way back in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy, but he said, in these days when people say that the law of Moses doesn't matter, you go through the book of Judges, you'll hardly get a reference to the tabernacle. You'll hardly get a reference to the priest. If I remember right, there's one single reference to the Ark of the Covenant in the book of Judges. The law of Moses and the things of Moses have almost been completely forgotten. And yet in those days, there's a man. He says, if God gives the law, he says, I do my best to keep it. And not only to keep it because I have to do it. He said, I'll do it with a gladness in my heart, with a grace in my attitude, and with a generosity in my soul. I tell you, here a man with commitment in debt of carelessness, and he wants to see things done properly. I was having a deadline, and I don't want to be harping on about it. It didn't happen just 1,000 miles from here. And I know I'm giving it a very ordinary down-to-earth application, but I'll say this. There was a girl got saved far as I know, reading the Bible at home. Her husband wasn't saved, but he had previous links with his family. And he told his wife that this year he'd go up to leave off. But she wanted some fellowship, so on, some teaching. So up to the leave off she went. She came in, and she sat down, and she got up, and she went out. And nobody said you're living or dead. Nobody said you're black or white. Nobody said you're saved or lost. Nobody looked the room that you was on. They just let her come and go. I tell you, all I'll say is this, and one thing I'm 100% sure of it. You see, in that place, if you ever had a Lord, she wouldn't have got away with it. And then if we sit like, we sit and wonder, why does nobody come? Why do we not get people? I tell you, there are quite a number of places, and they have a gospel ball in the door, and if they want me to go and tell them why they don't get people, it'll take about 2 nights to tell them. But I do it in no uncertain terms. I can tell you, why they don't get it. You see, here a man has commitment. He not only loves the land, but he has a commitment to the law. Then I want to think about his commitment to his laborer. No. I think it would have been a joy to work for this. When he came walking into the field, he said to his neighbor, the Lord be with you. And they answered him back, the Lord bless you. Wasn't that a most unusual salutation? A salutation that was rich, and he brought the Lord into the business of the field. He brought the name of the Lord into the business of harvesting and reaping. The Peter then tells us that he commanded the young man. You see, he had a beautiful balance of authority and affection. There was a fellowship, and there was a communication between the owner of the field and the officer in the field. And the operators in the field, everything seemed to be going just according to a beautiful order. I say again, here's a man's commitment. This is God's field. This is a field which God has given to me as my divinely allotted inheritance. And he said, if God has given this to me, he said, everything that I do with it and in it and about it, I seek to do it with that God gave me of commitment. Now, I have to stretch. Switch for that, and we take a look at the gleaner. We move now and take a look at Ruth, because if ever there's a beautiful picture of commitment, it's just in Ruth. The first little matter, or not little, I say it's nice to see Ruth's commitment to her mother-in-law. Now you have heard as many stories about daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law that I have. And they tell me that it's a very wonderful and a very, very sparky relationship. And I wouldn't want to say anything too much about it, but I hear you have it. Here's a daughter-in-law and a mother-in-law. They're both widows. Here's a younger woman, and we're going to see how she relates to an older woman. The older woman is a Bethlehemite. The younger woman is a Moabite. The older woman has known the Lord for years and has passed through very, very many different experiences under the hand of God. The younger woman is just a fresh convert. These two women are divided socially and racially, nationally. There's quite a division, but the only thing they have in common is that they both have wept together. And they're poor. And they have come back now into the land. It must have been quite a traumatic experience just to think of these two ladies. One of them coming to a land where she'd never been before, and another coming to a land Let us think about poor Naomi for a minute. Well, she is the miracle. I'm sure when she walked through the village, on her arrival back, she could remember places that she and Elimelech was in. And she could see the street where the two boys had fled. And when she said, "I'm not late, wherever it was, where it was hunting," there were three voices that she must have heard echoing in the wall. She never hear them again. She must, in one sense, be glad to be back. But at the same time, humanly and realistically speaking, she must be crushed with sorrow. Now I say, it appears to me beautifully that this younger lady, she undertook to do as much for the older lady as she could possibly do. Now there are two things that I want to speak about in Ruth's commitment to the widow. First of all, she asked for permission. At the start of the chapter, Ruth didn't just walk out and leave to anybody. I don't know if you have any more should be putting about in here. But she asked Naomi's permission. Naomi said, "Go." That's the start of the chapter. Once you get to the end of the chapter, Naomi said to Ruth, she said to Ruth, she says, "That man has been so kind to you." She says, "My advice is, you don't go to any other thing." Now, it might have been, a very tempting thing for this new arrival into a whole district of countryside where she had never been before. It might have been very tempting for her to do a little bit of exploring and go around different places and see how it worked in different places. That would have been very, very tempting, and that would have been just like it. But you see, when our mother and father said to her, "I would advise you not to," the Bible tells us that she stayed there from the beginning up to the end of the week. Now, she didn't only, at the start of the chapter, what I'm saying is this, at the start of the chapter, she asked her mother-in-law's permission. At the end of the chapter, she accepted her mother-in-law's advice. She was committed to the older woman. And she showed the older woman all the respect that one could ever think of. You know, we have great problems. Well, I shouldn't say great problems, but I don't see them that much. But from time to time I hear about them. I hear about people at difficulties with old and young. There are a few younger folks here. Can I say to you tonight, and say to myself, as still belonging to that noble category, can I say, it's our bounden duty to show the maximum amount of respect to older Christians. Now we might not always agree with them. You remember Paul said to Timothy, "Rebuke not an old man." And he said, "The older women entreat as mothers." Now here's a girl, and she's committed with respect to her widow mother-in-law. I want to speak a little bit about her commitment to the work. Not only the commitment to the widow, but her commitment to the work. She was the one who suggested going out to glean. She didn't have to be pushed out. She didn't have to be told to go. She didn't have to be coaxed or forced. She volunteered. She said to her mother-in-law, she said, "Is it all right, please, may I now go and glean in some place?" She said, "Here we are back," and she said, we have no food, and we have very little sustenance or support." She said, "If you're willing to let me, and if you think it's available, I'll go and glean." Now, I don't need to tell you that gleaning was a nice job. In the very sub of an Easter setting, it was warm work. It wasn't a popular task. It was a task that was at the bottom of the social ladder. It was wrong-fitting and it was back-bending and back-breaking to go to grace. It was, in short, a humiliating thing. But here it is. And I give her the highest marks because rather than they are sponge, she accepted the task that was much beneath her dignity, and she wasn't afraid to do it. And she went with a voluntariness that she would. You know, even in assembly life, and I'm just making a broad application, there are people that they may never have a right to run this world. But they do exist in parts of this countryside, and they certainly exist across the world. There are people who have a natural aversion to work. If you punish them, and if you force them, they'll do it. But if you let them pay for them doing it, well, the millennium will be here and over. And everything winds up. You see, in assembly life, it's the same. You have people, and they sit, and they stare, and even some sleep. But as far as ever getting involved, and ever rolling up their sleeves, and bending their back, and bending their knees, and getting down to the surface of things, they would never dream of doing it in a thousand years. Now, Ruth was not like that. She had a commitment to work in whatever field would accept her. Now, if there's somebody here today that you have moved you up, I have full sympathy with you, for I suffered unemployment myself on the stage. And I say this to you. If you are unemployed, don't you be too proud to accept a very menial task. Don't be too proud to do that. I don't think that Ruth ever crossed her mind. The day that she got down on her knees in that field and searched through the stubble for her first few grains of barley, I don't think it crossed her mind that this is actually God's corridor that's going to lead me to the happiest period of my life. Within, I would say, 3 months, she happily married to one of the noblest men in the land. She had got right up. But the girl who got up was a girl who wasn't afraid to go down and accept what I have just read. Now, not only did she go to the place of work, but we have quite a number of things said about her when she was at her work. See, there are some people who go, but they don't do very much when they're there. And I see so many smiles here. I don't know whether it's the smile of assent or whether it's the grin of guilt, but I'll not pursue with any further investigation. You see, she went and says, you know what she says? When the man, when the supervisor was talking, he said, you know, go home. She said, just, she just walked in. No. She said, she politely came and asked me, would it be all right? Here's a girl. She's a Moabite. I tell you, she has manner. He says, she politely asked me, you know, from the start of the thing this morning, he says, she's never stopped before. He says, she's never slept. And she said, well, all the other fellows came in for a tea break, into the house, possibly a little shelter in the field. He said, we could hardly get them out. But he said, she only stayed here for a minimum amount of time. He said, she's a worker. So that the supervisor, he was able to give this girl the highest commendation. She had a willingness to work. She had a sense of initiative. She had a humility. She was willing to accept a menial task. She had an industry. She kept at it. And at the end of the chapter tells us that she kept working right through until the evening of that day. Never slept! Never stop. And then when the boss did give her a few perks and a few little payments, you know, she fell asleep. And she thanked him profusely. Thanked him profusely for all the kindness and all the commitment that he had shown to her. I tell you, I know, you say the ministry is nearing us, is spirituality altogether. But then again, I feel, dear brothers and sisters, that even from the example of this new convert and this Moabite year, we can learn a beautiful picture of what commitment is. Don't be giving up. Don't be taking too much time on the side. Don't be stopping halfway through the day. Whether it's the cool of the morning, or the heat of midday, or the shadows of the evening, whatever circumstances it might be, always keep at it, because we have the example. That shouldn't be a new convert to you. Can I say to you, one of the best things for your spiritual preservation is for you to get involved amongst the Lord's people as well. Get right into the thing. And get involved in it. And don't be afraid to glean and work and do your best, even at the most menial tasks. It's no surprise to us that when the day was over, she had a hood, an ephah of barn. And the scholars tell me that that was a massive amount, almost unheard of. And some of the notes, when they debate just the actual weight of that, some of them even begin to wonder how she was able to carry it home to Naomi. When the day was over, she had something to show, and she was able to take it back to her mother-in-law. What an encouragement it must have been. Someone has said, I've heard them debate, why did Naomi not go? Well, too old. I heard that. She was strong enough to walk the mile from Moab. Well, I don't think it's too old. But think about it from a different standpoint. You know, it would have been easy for Naomi to go. She's not back. Years of sorrow behind her. She's going out to meet people that she hasn't met for years. With many of the faces that she would see, there would just roll across her mind some of the tenderest memories of years. I think the poor figure just couldn't sit. It was just emotionally and psychologically too much for her, and it's very precious for me to see that the younger woman took the heavy end of the load. And she went out and did her best, and brought back something that was an encouragement. Now I conclude just a minute. The commitment of Boaz, and the older man, and the commitment of the new convert, if you like to speak of it that way, the commitment of Ruth. But of course there's a far bigger commitment in this chapter that a kind of hovers in the background. And it's the most important commitment of all. I want to say just a couple of words about the commitment of the Lord. You see, the Lord was committed to this. He was behind us. He watched these two people, this man Boaz and this girl Ruth, and he watched them as they diligently fulfilled what came to their hearts, and as they fulfilled the duties of everyday life. And above it all, God was working out his own providential purpose. There's that lovely expression, it says about Ruth, that she went to him and her heart. You've always thought about that, haven't you? Her heart was to light on the part of the field that belonged to those. You say, what is the big coincidence? I noticed one translation of a modern flavor said she was looking. I even hear a Christian say, you've been looking. A man told me one time, he said, well, did anybody got saved? And the meeting guy said, not that I know of. Oh, well, he says, keep preaching away, you'll be more looking than the next time. Oh well, it's wonderful, this luck business, isn't it? Luck. It's a pile of rubbish. It was nothing to do with luck, it was the Lord. That she should pick out
She didn't know one field from another, or one part of the field. She didn't know who owned it or anything of it, but she's just going to do her duty. She knows that we need bread. I'm going to go and glean. I'm going to do what I need to do. And I'm going to do it with a heart and a half. She knows nothing about me.
But the Lord gave her very good sense. But on that very day, she touched the very field that belonged to him, and it was the very day that he came to see her.
Her heart.
No, I think all of us should be encouraged by the fact that even in ordinary life, without looking for any big thing, in ordinary life, I think we should appreciate it, that the Lord gazed in God, and he allowed the combination of circumstances and the meeting of people. There's not a person here with any degree of seriousness about life. And you can consider your past. And you can see different junctions. Things that weren't planned, things that weren't next. You were just doing what you thought needed to be done. You were just fulfilling the course of your life. And yet God brought into your life people and events. Decisions were made. Directions were changed. Opportunities were open. And now looking back, you're able to see something of the significance of what took place in the simplest of circumstances. You know when Ruth was nursing that little baby, away in the end of the book, and when there was such celebration and rejoicing, I tell you her mind would have gone back to the day when she went into the gleaning phase. And she never thought of such a great destiny hinge upon what seemed to be such a small human thing. You'll go to studies tomorrow. You're going to your work. You're going back to the desk. You're going back to the workshop. You're going back to the telephone, to the office, to the factory, whatever it might be. I know that life can become humdrum. But may I say, don't despise tomorrow. You know what you have to do. But we never know what the Lord thinks. You say, what then should I have that he's living in? Should I be wishing and watching for big things? No. I tell you what it is. Just you let your life be marked by commitment. Commitment. Conviction. Concern for the needed. And compassion. And the features of the lives of these noble people are in our life. God can use us as he did them to advance. I trust the Lord will help us in this very simple little word. We have a totally different side of things in this world tomorrow night, but just this simple illustration of commitment. Our Father, we have the Lord Jesus' precious name. We thank thee again for the depth of thy word, and also we thank thee for its pure simplicity. These precious garments from an ancient saint, we know that these were ordinary people, yet the names of some of them will be inscribed in our hearts with eternal significance. Many of these folks lived their days, and they didn't know that they had found a place in the great book of inspiration. We know that Ruth would never think that a number of people would be reading about her hundreds of years after she was dead, and seeking to follow her example. Father, help us to appreciate that we are making a mark on this thing, and that wonder thy good hand, and flexible to thy will, and sensitive to thy word, that we may seek to conduct our lives with a suitable sense of spiritual commitment, so that the mark will be, may be for thine eternal. We ask for these mercies and we seek thy blessing upon every individual and commit our homeward journey into thy gracious caring hand in the precious name of our Lord. Amen. Just a